The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining me today. I'm still waiting for my sound to come up on this September 21st, 2013, marking the autumn equinox, and it sure feels like it here. It's cooled down quite a bit after several days of beautifully heavy rain, off and on, the best kind. Is that when it's off and on like that, which I associate with the hurricanes in Mexico, but that might not be the cause. Anyway, before I get into my subject, was the Third Reich immoral? I want to give a mention to a story from the United Kingdom that came out a few days ago. It was in the Telegraph about David Cameron. Says the Prime Minister announced that the government will increase funding for the Holocaust Educational Trust, known as the HET, by an extra £300,000 a year. Now notice that you've got the government funding this thing called Holocaust Educational Trust, which is actually something just created by Jews, British Jews. It's all Jews. It's only Jews that are involved in it, in the running of it, of course, it's to push what's in their interests. But the government funds them because this is just an extra £300,000 a year. They've just increased the amount. That isn't the total amount or the first time they've been funding it. They've been funding it all along. How does this work? Anyway, the extra funds will allow more children to take part in the trust's Lessons from Auschwitz project, which allows students and teachers to visit the former Nazi concentration and death camp Auschwitz-Birkenau. And Cameron also, at the same time, launched a new National Holocaust Commission, which will set up a permanent Holocaust memorial in Britain. Permanent. I guess it sounds like something like the museum that we have in Washington, D.C., something. I don't know that there is a museum like that in Britain or in London, that anywhere that I know of, but they've been convinced that they need to have one there too. So they're going to create this permanent memorial in Britain, which will no doubt be the same thing as what we have in Washington. Which is called the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Mr. Cameron also told the Trust appeal dinner that, because, you know, they have these appeal dinners every year, this Holocaust Educational Trust, and they naturally invite the Prime Minister and all kinds of other politicians to come, and they're always raising money for their wonderful project, and they, Cameron was speaking there, and he said, at a time when anti-Semitism is returning in some parts of mainland Europe, it is more important than ever that as a whole country that we do everything possible to make sure that the memory of the Holocaust is preserved from generation to generation. And naturally he praises says the Holocaust Educational Trust are leading the way and it is vital that they are supported. Yeah, well, this just shows us that Jews run the government there, that the Jewish interests are the interests of the British people. They're confused. They've confused that, and it's been that way for a long time. And it gets bolder and bolder. So this is what we have to look forward to. And these people who say, well, this Holocaust is ready to break wide open. I don't agree with that, but of course it's possible that as this stuff gets more and more people realize what's going on, that it will. Maybe people will have had it up to the top of their head pretty soon. It's hard to say, but Cameron is also going to be visiting Auschwitz next year in 2014, and at the same time in connection with him chairing the first meeting of the new multi-faith cross-party commission later this year. Now, what is this new multi-faith cross-party commission? I don't know. It certainly is not the Holocaust Educational Trust. Now, I've been talking about the opposition to the National Socialist State from the church and individual Christians, and from popes and bishops, all the way to individual citizens. And much of the opposition was actually, the opposition to National Socialism was actually political, but presented under a veneer of Christian or ethical concerns. For an example, Robert Scholl, the father of the Hans and Sophie Scholl, was a social democrat politician well before 1933, when he became part of the anti-Nazi, not the serious resistance at that time, but the just generally politically opposed to Hitler. And I've talked about the White Rose Society and its supposed basis on Christian concerns for morality. And they said that the German people were becoming immoral under Hitler's dictatorship, what they always called it. And I mentioned some individual Christian pro-white, pro-German, anti-Holocaust persons. Notice these were pro-white, pro-German, anti-Holocaust, but they accused Hitler of being immoral. And those two were Michael Hoffman and Michael Kohlhaas, which I'm going to go into further as the show goes on. So, as I say, I'm going to go into more detail today because this interests me very much. And first, I just want to say that I like Europe being considered a Christian continent and a Christian civilization. I don't have any problem with that. I don't particularly like the pagan. I wouldn't like to see it change over to that. I can't quite picture it. But the pagan ideas can be present in the separate nations with their ancient traditions, etc. You see what I mean by that? If each nation or national group, you know, maybe you say the Germanic could go together, but really, like the Scandinavians have their Norse gods and traditions and so on. The Germans have a little bit different Germanic gods and traditions, and the say the Poles and the Hungarians have their own ancient traditions, and this is all good for these individual nations, these separate nations, to bring into their culture and talk about it. But I don't think that there is a pagan. Then you have, you know, Ireland, England, Ireland, the British Isles, connected with the Druids and so on. I don't think that one pagan kind of religion is suitable for all Europeans. But that's my view. Now, my view is that the political must rule, not the religious. And it must be strong enough to rule. I want a political head of state, not a priest ruler. If we say a state, I'm just kind of throwing out some, I actually edited severely before the show, because I had way too much to cover. So I knew that my commenting in the beginning had to be cut back. So this is why this might be a little choppy. But, if we say that a state is under God, and that sounds good. I don't have any problem with that at all. I think it should be. A state is under God. But what does that mean? Who's God? And how do we know what God is saying to us? How do we know what God wants? Well, generally, it's by church doctrine. That's what I think. That's how it's been. Church doctrine, which puts the churches in a strong position, which is what they want. But the church changes according to political change also. And an example of that is the latest news from Pope Francis. Some call him the anti-pope, which seems fitting. And now he's come out to relax the Catholic Church rules on abortion, contraception, and gay marriage, and he says that moral and doctrinal issues should not be overemphasized, at the cost of losing the freshness and fragrance of the gospel. That is, you know, being loving and caring and making everybody feel that God loves them and accepts them. You know, I'm going into this just a little bit because it fits with the subject of the program, that if the Third Reich was immoral and it was called immoral by those who in large part followed the church, either the Catholic Church or the Protestant churches at the time, you know, how moral are they? Of course, we can talk about the immorality of every leading nation of the world in their policies throughout history, and the immoralities carried out by the churches and all of this. But, you know, we're just not going to go into all that. But here, right now, the new Pope and the Catholic Church, it turns out that according to these polls, that Catholics have hailed what the Pope has said in the United States, U.S. Catholics. That's what they think. The U.S. Catholics are the most liberal in the world. So that's why they're talking about them. And here's some results of some polling. By 55% of most 55% of American Catholics, according to the poll, say abortion should be legal in all or most cases. This is a Washington Post ABC poll in July. 55% of most, no, 80, did that one, 82% of U.S. Catholics say birth control is morally acceptable. Well, I don't, that was from Gallup last year. I don't see anything surprising in that. I mean, Catholics have been practicing birth control no matter what the church's official policy is for a long time, and I don't know any that doesn't, unless they can't, you know, don't have access to any, which almost everybody does today in the world. So in March, another poll, the Quinnipiac, if it makes a difference to you, found that most Catholics, again, U.S. Catholics, were 54% in support of same-sex marriage. That's one that's surprising. And it's higher than it was in the previous poll. There's, you know, they're coming along on that. Catholic voters are leading American voters toward support for same-sex marriage. How do they account for that? I mean, how do they justify that, these Catholics? It shows how the general media and the liberalism has affected people's religious views to a great extent. The last one is 62% say priests should be allowed to marry. That's high. Well, that's pretty high. 64% support Obama's position that religious-based institutions such as hospitals and universities must arrange for their insurance companies to provide birth control coverage for employees. No, that was the wrong number there. This number came at the end. 51% thought that. So, you know, that means Catholic-owned and Catholic-run hospitals and universities, the Catholics themselves think that they insurance should provide birth control coverage for employees. I suppose they want to have it. You have to ask yourself if, you know, how moral you think that is, whether you're Catholic or not. A lot of people think these things are immoral, and I think some of them are immoral, too. So you know, who's being immoral? But that's just to point that out. Now, to continue, confused, and there's a lot of confused stuff on the Internet written in comments or in articles, blogs, and so on by white nationalists. And one I came upon this week was, I'm just going to quote this one sentence from it. I don't have any use for Christianity personally, but I have no problem if someone else does. That's up to them to decide. So long as the white race and nature are above all, then they are my ally. Well, I have to point out, and I have to admit, too, that I haven't always thought about this myself. And I may have said some things like that, but I hope not, because it's pretty stupid. If you are a Christian, really a Christian, you cannot place nature above all. You can't even place the white race above all. But you see, you have to place God and Christ above all. That has to come. So for him to say, well, I don't mind people being Christian as long as they don't believe like a Christian and believe like an atheist, or believe like a, you know, a naturist or something. Well, see, it doesn't work that way. And we need to recognize the contradictions that exist in what we're saying, and see and kind of probe more deeply into it, is what I'm thinking, and find out why we can't get together. And there's plenty of good reasons why we can't, why we don't get together. And I don't see how we're ever going to all get together in this way. But anyway, I'll just go on. I'm not solving that tonight. Another thing I want to bring up before I get into this is this head of the Jobbik Party in Hungary, Gábor Vona. The Jobbik Party in Hungary is one of the best parties. I don't know, it might even be better than the Golden Dawn, in that it's not making all that kind of news, but it's very clear, and it's never, this Gábor Vona never fails to say what I think is the perfect answer to things. And he is a, he has written, okay, he did an interview with actually a Romanian, I think it's a Romanian magazine or something, TV network or something. And he answers, he always is very honest and doesn't hedge around. And he said in this that we are, he called the Jobbik a radically patriotic Christian party. And I think this sounds good to me. I like the sound of it. And probably Hungarians can do that, because they're talking about their own individual group of Hungarians. They can be patriotic and Christian. But still, Vona had to explain himself and how that worked. And the interviewer said, the EU has a clear and visible anti-Christian bias in its policies affecting the education system, family law, etc. Is it hard to be a Christian party and promote Christian values? So you got that? They're saying that, you know, the EU is anti-Christian, really. It's a communistic, globalist, dictatorial, one-world government thing, not Christian. That's why so many of us defend Christianity, because it's, you know, the worst enemy hates it. And that's the truth, the Jews. I didn't mention the Jews in all of that. It is hard, so he says, how can you be a Christian party? So Gábor Vona says, talking about Christian values, we must clarify certain things. We are not a clerical missionary party. That's good to clarify, because the Catholic Church is clerical and missionary. He says, we are not a, and you know, Hungary is a Catholic country. It's not as Catholic as it used to be. Nothing is as Catholic as it used to be, but it has a large segment of Catholics and some, I don't know how many. I not too long ago, I actually gave the breakdown of the party, the religious affiliation in Hungary, and I've forgotten it. So there you go. But he says, in our opinion, the opinion of the Jobbik Party, Christian values are in fact identical with the universal and ancient human values such as God, order, hierarchy, courage, truth, sacrament. And being natural in a community, which he says are natural in a community, as opposed to modern individualism, valuelessness, deviance, and liberalism. So in, he is redefining, or he is defining, I'll say, Christian values and Christian country as different from some others would. And he didn't mention Christ in his list of words here, but he did say sacrament. We often connect that with the sacraments in the Christian church that involve your belief in Christ, but you can have sacraments that don't, but I'm sure he includes that, but he doesn't want to say. He just says God in the other thing. So then he says, the reason why we call them Christian values, these things he listed, is because we live in a Christian culture. And that is why we do not have any problems with Muslim, Buddhist, or other cultures if they are based on the same foundations. That is, they have their own culture, you know, and we don't have any problem with other religions having, you know, where they are having their own cultures. In this regard, it is indeed hard to promote our political values because we, unlike the so-called Christian Democratic parties, really face the challenge. We really face the challenge, he's saying. We really go down to the root of the problems and also speak out on issues considered taboo. So that's his answer to the Christian, how they call themselves a Christian party, and they're still National Socialists. He doesn't use that word, but they are, and have those same values. And I think he does a pretty good job of it, I will say. Again, he's speaking as a Hungarian nationalist. He's not speaking for all of Europe or all the world, although, you know, I'd like to. But all right, now I'm going to go on to the White Rose have more, a lot more information about that. I think it's important to go through. No, wait a minute. I'm going to just mention Robert, a couple of people first. And I'm going to talk about, I looked up Robert Scholl on Wikipedia, the father of Hans and Sophie Scholl. And I think he bears a lot of responsibility for what happened. He was born in 1891. He met his wife during World War I while they were serving in the same hospital. And they married shortly after that. And she was 10 years older than him. So they're both hospital workers during the war. So that natural for her. She was a nurse. But he got that probably because he didn't want to go into combat. And then he married this woman, 10 years older than himself. But they seemed to do all right together. They stayed together and moved to Ingersheim, it's probably would be pronounced, in 1920. Then they moved again to Forstenberg. And in both of these places, he was the mayor of the town. So he being politically minded, he tried to get the job of mayor wherever he lived, it seems to me, because that made a living for him, because I don't think he had a real profession or ability, you know, to earn money in any way. He was kind of a dreamy-headed guy, I would say, and a liberal, you know, dreamy liberal. And then in 1930, they moved to Ludwigsburg, and in 1932, they moved to Ulm. So that was four moves in those years. They stayed in Ulm. And he there founded a tax and accounting service company. He had to go to night school to learn that, and then he founded this. So he was a lifelong liberal Democrat. He was a critic of the Nazi Party, as I said. And his children, though, like most at that time, were active in the Nazi youth organizations. Either they didn't call it that, the National Socialist or the Hitler Youth organizations. And their father was, it says here, incapable of dissuading them otherwise. However, they soon decided for themselves they didn't like it. Well, they heard all that at home. And in 1942, while either before or during the time that they had formed their resistance organization, Hans, I don't know when in 1942 this was, but the father, Robert, was sentenced to 4 months in prison for calling Adolf Hitler the scourge of God. That was, that's what they say there. You don't know how true that is, but, that's what the story is. That's what he did wrong. And he probably said a lot more than that, but, that was one of the things that was considered going. So as an opponent of the regime, and it was wartime, 1942, they gave him a four-month prison sentence. So this is at the time that Hans was forming his ideas of a resistance movement. So you know that the whole family, you know, was involved in this. I mean, it was the mood of the house, of the household. And another prison sentence that Scholl got. And in one program, I wrongly said that I thought he was executed at the end of the war, before the end of the war, but that was wrong. What happened was that in 43, February 43, 5 days after the execution of his children, of Hans and Sophie, because you remember they were arrested on the 18th, and then they quickly, after a few days, they had the trial and they were executed that very day. And so 5 days after that, Scholl was sentenced to 18 months in prison for listening to enemy radio broadcasts. Well, this means the whole family was listening to them, as I mentioned. And it's mentioned elsewhere, too, that they were listening to foreign radio broadcasts. And they may have known that for some time, but probably after the execution of his children, they thought it was a good time to get him off the streets and get him, you know, out, you know, put him away for a while, in case he had some, you know, ideas in mind, or he was going to, you know, get revenge or start something or become more active or whatever. So that all fits together. But the fact is that he probably was, because they always used evidence. I don't think they had show trials. They didn't bring people up on charges that were false. They always showed evidence and they made a proper trial out of it the way you're supposed to do. Now, and then more about this, Robert, after the war, in fact, as soon as the war was over in June 1945, he became mayor of Ulm again. Now, I guess for the first time, he became mayor of Ulm. So he's back into his mayoral campaigns and living off the people. And in 1952, he founded the German People's Party along with some other men, which was a liberal, I don't know, some kind of a liberal party, a liberal people's party. Now, the sister, Ang Scholl, the eldest sister, according to Wikipedia, her Wikipedia page, it says that according to the Center for White Rose Studies, she did not even so much as listen to her siblings talk when they, during 1942, tried to convince her to take part. So the thing I noticed, you know, when I read the book that I got from Patty last week, and it's pretty interesting. I'm really glad I have it, especially because of the index, which has the full transcripts of all the trials and everything that was said. I'm going to get into that in the second hour. So I found that very interesting, more than the book, because the book that Ang Scholl supposedly authored is, I thought, as soon as I started reading it, I thought, this woman did not write this book. This is propaganda from the U.S. Department of, the intelligence, or, you know, it was part of the denazification program. I could tell that right away as I was reading it, and I'll point out some things in it that will tell you that too. But what I did was, I went to that Center for White Rose Studies to see that what Ang Scholl had said. This was after I read the book, and so I'm going to read. They did a pretty good job of, because this is an organization that has some buildings and everything, and they are supposedly, they believe in the White Rose, what they believed in, and they want to, you know, advance it and promulgate it. So they have this center where they study all these issues, and they probably have studied the storyline pretty good. So I'm going to read the storyline that they give here. I hope it won't take too long. It can be quicker to just read it than to try to tell about it. So they say on their website, which is whiterosestudies.org /their-story.html, November and December 1942, these three, which they mean, by that they mean Hans, Alex Schmorell, and Willy, what was his last name? Willy Graf. Plus Sophie Christoph, which is Shurik's best, who was Alex's best friend. They call Alex Shurik throughout this thing. And Traute, who was Hans's old girlfriend and a dissident in Hamburg long before there was a White Rose. So she was a longtime Democrat liberal, I guess. And these six plotted the expansion that would begin in 1943. Hans and Alex traveled, Alex Schmorell, traveled to Chemnitz to meet Falk Harnack. Falk Harnack was mentioned, I mentioned him last show, but now I find out, the brother of Arvid Harnack, the same Arvid Harnack who was soon to be executed for his own resistance work with the Rote Kapelle. The Rote Kapelle was Red Chapel in English, and that was a big spy organization that did a lot of damage. Not as bad as what later came to light, but, you know, it was doing a lot. It was working for the Russians. And so this Falk Harnack was the brother of this guy, and these kids, they were in their 20s, but they found out about him. They knew about him. They probably knew about a lot of things that are never brought up because they're portrayed as innocent young people who were just brutally executed by the Hitler monsters. So then it says that they, at this meeting, they discussed combining forces with the remaining dissidents in Berlin centered around the Bonhoeffer brothers. So now this is again the Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor, and either one or more, I don't know how many brothers he had. Maybe it was just one brother, but they were all involved in this. So over Christmas, they write, all six of these named youngsters actively recruited new members. Some pleas fell on deaf ears. Aang Shoal would not so much as listen to her siblings talk. Willie's best friend, and I believe that because why do I believe it? Maybe because I read things like this previously, that, you know, that she wasn't interested in it, and there's never any talk that she was had any involvement whatsoever. Willie's best friend and Willie Graf's best friend in Saarbrücken similarly rebuffed any discussion of resistance. But they did find others who wanted to help, and they were starting to form a network. So they'd also undertaken the risky business of traveling to other southern German cities to mail the leaflets so the Gestapo would think a large, well-organized group was behind the seditious activities. Need to remind people again that, you know, the Gestapo has such a horrible reputation as a, you know, as a, I don't know, secret police of some terrible kind, that we need to remember it was just the federal police force, Gestapo, German state police. It was just like the FBI, you know, I guess somewhat comparable to the FBI in our country. So they wanted them to think that they were a large, well-organized group. And their subterfuge, though, never worked. Even before their arrest, the police had tracked down paper and envelope sources and identified the brand of the typewriter they used and had already determined that everything originated in Munich. So their efforts of going around to different cities and mailing their leaflets was a waste of time. The students had also managed to recruit their favorite professor, Dr. Kurt Huber. He wrote the sixth leaflet when Falk, the brother of the Rote Kapelle member, came to Munich to meet with these rebels. Dr. Huber joined the conversation. Sadly, that meeting, which was on February 9th or 10th or 11th, I'm not sure, 1943. So as you know, they were arrested in February 18th. So it was just like a week before that. That represented the beginning of the end of the White Rose. Because Hans allowed his new girlfriend, Gisela Schertling, to stay in the room for the entire meeting, though he was fully aware that she was a loyal Nazi. They have some bones to pick with Hans here, thinking that Hans was responsible for what happened because things he wasn't careful enough. And it says the others protested her presence. Falk Harnack was particularly disturbed by it, but Hans insisted she stay. Now that's hard to understand, but it's obviously true because she was a problem later on. So you can't understand why he would do that. Was he so in need of impressing his girlfriends? I guess so. Additionally, the conversation revealed that while they were united in their opposition to Hitler, their views about what needed to be done and what Germany would look like post-war were too divergent. Falk championed a planned economy, that's what they had at the time, which Huber found too communistic an approach. Huber insisted that Hitler could only be overthrown by a military coup, and that therefore their primary goal should be recruitment within the military, while Hans believed that Hitler would be brought down by the man on the street, if only the man on the street could be made to understand the atrocities. We have similar differences of opinion. Even today, I suppose every movement has this type of difference of opinion. So it goes on, Dr. Huber therefore broke all ties with Hans Scholl after that meeting. And it was because he had written that sixth leaflet, and he was in favor of having the let's see if I already got this down here, of having the members of the White Rose join the military and resistor people who are willing to help in the resistance to join the military and then be a force within the military to change, you know, influence the opinion of the soldiers and so on. But Hans didn't like that idea, and he thought it was the man in the street who should do it. And so he took that sentence out of the sixth leaflet that Huber had written, and that made Huber so mad, he wanted none of it. He said that his whole leaflet was meaningless without that sentence. and he walked out. He said he was finished. He was mad at Hans. And Alex Schmorell, as well, decided it had come time to say goodbye. And he had gotten Lilo's, remember this Lilo Romdahl's assistance, his friend, in burning his uniform and paybook. His last act of friendship for Hans was that he agreed to stand guard outside the university when they scattered leaflets on February 18th. After that, he was going to head to Russia to hide out, try to get into Russia. If he was still a soldier, he could have done it, I guess, to hide out till the end of the war, when he then planned to work for the liberation of his homeland. As you recall, he's half Russian. He felt more Russian than anything else. He would be long gone before the next scheduled roll call. I guess that's when they meet or something. And Willie Graf also, they say, likewise spent a long weekend away from Munich and to clear his head, and appears that he too had decided to break with Hans. Willie was level-headed and irresponsible, and Hans's carelessness with the leaflets, leaving them out in plain view in their apartment, was apparently more than Willie could bear. And then there was a bookshop owner who helped them out, Joseph Songen, supplying them with banned volumes, censored, you know, books. Likewise warned Hans Scholl that he was taking too many risks and endangering the lives of his friends. And that warning came on February 16th, 2 days before they were arrested. But Hans, being the charismatic young man that he was, they write, convinced all of them to stick it out for one more operation. The week of February 18th, they worked long hours printing more leaflets, doing their third and final graffiti job. Yeah, they also did a big graffiti job a few days before that, their arrest, which angered the police. And Sophie confided to a friend, Wilhelm Geyer, that if they were caught, they would not allow themselves to be arrested privately. They would make sure it was very public. You know, they would make a lot of noise about it, so they could not be handled quietly. Sophie had overestimation about what they were capable of and what the people would do if they were arrested and so on. That she thought the people would rise up, which, of course, they didn't do. When they went to the university on the 18th to drop all these whole suitcase full of leaflets, new leaflets they had, which would have been, I don't know if it was number 5 or number 6 leaflet, but Schmied, the superintendent, saw them, as we know that already. And It says here that Sophie had enough presence of mind to dart into a third floor room, it seems to have been the women's restroom, and hide the key to Ike Meyer's studio. That was that person who loaned them his art studio while he was away for a number of months. They could have their meetings there in his studio. Hans remained his irresponsible self, they say, and did not ensure that he was clean. When Schmid apprehended them, his pockets still contained Christoph Probst's handwritten draft of a seventh leaflet and cigarette ration coupons that could be easily traced back to the Geyer family. So, as you know, if you're going to go on a mission like that where you never know what might happen, you don't carry evidence in your pockets. But he may have been foolish enough to think that it was not signed or anything. So it wouldn't get anybody else in trouble. But you know what the police did? They even though Hans had tried at the last minute, he realized he had it there, and he tried to tear it up and put it in his mouth and swallow it. But he was unsuccessful, and they pulled it out of his mouth. And I mean, it was too late for that. They were already there, and they pulled it out of his mouth, and they pieced it all together. And through handwriting analysis, through finding other writing of Christoph Probst, they knew that it was written by him. So there you go, police work. The Gestapo were very good policemen, and policemen are supposed to be very good. You know, they didn't have to use brutality and all these things that they're accused of all the time. I'm not saying that, they didn't hurt people at times, but they wouldn't hurt these young people. You know, I mean, they weren't, it just wasn't that way. They did good police work is what they did. So it goes on a little bit more, a couple more paragraphs here. Gosh, time goes by so fast. As Hans and Sophie were led from the university building, Hans shouted to Gisela, that's that new girlfriend of his that he allowed to sit in on the meetings. Tell him I won't be there for lunch, he shouted to her. Well, of course they would see him doing that. If she had any reaction to it, the police that were leading them out there, that wasn't very smart either. And it says that from the moment that Gisela was arrested, she was then arrested, the entire group was compromised. In an effort to obtain leniency, she named every name she could remember, including people who were on the fringe of the fringe. Above all, she named Dr. Huber, their university professor, who was not under suspicion in the least. So he would have gotten away, but he ended up being executed because of the stupidity of, seems to be mostly of Hans. And then this Gisela, knowing she was a supporter of the National Socialist State, but he must have liked her. He must have had so much conceit that he thought he could change her mind or something. Most perplexing of all, this is what they say, and these are people who are on their side and have studied it a lot, but they seem to, I didn't find this in the transcripts, but anyway, Hans completely denounced Alex Schmorell and Christoph in his interrogation, they say. And Sophie targeted Traute. That was Hans's first girlfriend, who was a known dissident type of person. Now, maybe they were trying to, they said they had this plan to put all blame on themselves and not to involve anybody else, to take it all on themselves. But maybe they found it necessary to say some things about the others, and then maybe they didn't want to, but they did. I don't know. Anyway, it says, in contrast, Willy Graf did not denounce even one of his friends, and Alex Schmorell denied any involvement of his friends, especially covering for Lilo, whom the Gestapo considered very dangerous indeed. It says there, however, this Lilo was not charged with anything. She was held for about a month. She was interrogated a lot, but she was not, no charges were brought against her. And there's just recently there was a story in a British newspaper, BBC, the BBC news magazine had this story very recently, and I happened to find it, and it was about her. She's currently 99 years old, this woman, and they say very spry. And they had a picture of her at 99 and a picture of her as this young woman at the time of the White Rose business. And her name was Lyselott, L-I-S-E-L-O-T-T-E, Forst hyphen Ramdor. So they called her Lilo, and her, I think she was married to a man named Ramdor, who was killed in the war before this happened. He had already been killed. And she was already a widow. She was 29 years old when she, when this all took place, and her husband died on the Russian front, and she was friends. She became, I don't know how long she'd been friends with Alexander Schmorell, and he introduced her to the White Rose Group. And she says in this interview, "I can still see Alex today as he told me about it. He never said a word. He never said the word resistance. He just said that the war was dreadful, with the battles and so many people dying, and that Hitler was a megalomaniac, so they had to do something." And she says they must. She says about the time. She says the people in the White Rose thought that that the people should be able to tell how bad things were, but they didn't seem to notice it. They didn't think it was bad. That's why. And she never delivered any leaflets, but she did hide them in a broom cupboard in her flat. And she also helped Schmorell make stencils in her flat. They were especially good friends, those two. And the Down with Hitler stencils. And she, that's what she did, and went to some meetings. And she says that the activists were young and naive. She was older than, at 29, she was older than they were. That she was trying to be sort of helpful, and she thought they were young and naive, and that she says Sophie Scholl was so scared she used to sleep in her brother's bed, and Hans was very afraid too, but they wanted to keep going for Germany because they loved their country. And after the arrest, the whole group was thrown into a panic. You know, Alexander Schmorell went to Lilo Force flat, Lilo Ramdor's flat, and she helped him find new clothes and a fake passport. And he tried to go to Switzerland, but there was a heavy snow, which, you know, so he had to turn back. So then he was in Munich in hiding, and he was captured, she said, after a former girlfriend recognized him entering an air raid shelter during a bombing raid. He was arrested at that time. Now, so here's a former girlfriend of his. And she sees him, and she knows the whole story, I guess. She knows they're looking for him, you know. The Hans and Sophie and Willie have been arrested and are in prison. And this is before their trial. She reports on him. She's not loyal. She's not trying to help him. She's not even staying quiet. She reports him to the police, and they come and arrest him. I don't know. You know, that says a lot right there. Lilo said that she was arrested on March 2nd, and, 43, less than 2 weeks after they were. And she describes it this way. "Two Gestapo men came to the flat, and they turned everything upside down. They went through my letters, and then one of them said, 'I'm afraid you'll have to come with us.'" You see, once again, they're not grabbing her. They're not putting a bag over her head. They're not pulling her screaming out of the, you know, into a black van or anything. Because, as a matter of fact, you know, they're polite. And as a matter of fact, she says, "They took me to the Gestapo prison at the Wittelsbach Palais on the tram. They stood behind my seat so I couldn't escape." They didn't even have a transportation of their own, these these Gestapo agents. They had to travel around on the trains. And they had to even deliver her to the prison on the tram. So she spent a month in custody, was regularly interrogated, but released. It said, "A stroke of luck she puts down to her status as a war widow that might have something to do with it, and also to the likelihood that the Gestapo was hoping she would lead them to other co-conspirators." So that's probably very true. They thought if they, you know, one thing, she was a war widow. They put a lot of credence in things like that. I mean, it meant a lot. And she was, they thought they would follow her, you know, see where she, who she contacted after they let her go. I guess she seemed one of the least dangerous, although the other group says that they thought she was very dangerous. She knew that they were following her. She said, so if she knew they were following her, how they couldn't have been too secret, if she could tell. Anyway, nothing more happened to her. And, I'll just say this one comment. She ends up saying, this article ends up saying that, you know, that Alexander Shmorel was made a saint by the Russian Orthodox Church in 2012. And she says he would have laughed out loud if he'd known he wasn't a saint. He was just a normal person. Well, of course he wasn't a saint. Now it's time to, at this point, I would now talk about the book, by Eng Scholl, The White Rose, and give my, and so on. But first, I think it'd be better before that I talk about what these detractors, what Hitler's current detractors say about him. And you know, I'm gonna read some comments, some things written by Michael Hoffman on his website, which is revisionistreview.blogspot.com. And I looked up, you know, things about Hitler and National Socialism. And then I'm going to read from Michael Kohlhaas. So on Michael, now, these men are both Catholics. They're both pro-white. They're both pro-European. They're anti-Holocaust. They're all those good things. But they cannot tolerate Adolf Hitler because he was immoral. So we're going to look and see why and what they say. And Michael Hoffman, in his article about Oliver Stone's comments about Adolf Hitler, he wrote a few things. I'm just taking some excerpts here where Hitler's mentioned. Mostly he's not, but he writes the reaction against Oliver Stone, who merely pricked the gas bag of the monotonous holohoax propaganda industry. Now, he even calls it holohoax, Hoffman does, and then issued the de rigueur apology for telling the truth about it, is out of all proportion because Americans do not study what Orthodox Judaism actually teaches and care little or nothing for the Nazi-like crimes of the little Hitlers who serve the Israeli war machine while financed by U.S. taxpayers. So, you like that? I mean, he's another one who's really in a serious way comparing, in a derogatory way, comparing racist Israelis to Nazis. He obviously disapproves of racism. And now going on, Stone, he writes this. Stone says, Hitler was a stooge of the corporations. Stone says that. I say he was a stooge of deep cover Kabbalistic Judaism as manifested in the New Age occult beliefs that were his astrological religion. Now that makes no sense whatsoever. I think Michael Hoffman sometimes is quite kooky. New Age occult beliefs he's attributing to Hitler. Astrological religion he's attributing to Hitler. Hitler was not interested in any of that stuff. And I think that Hoffman sees Hitler as too much of a competition for Jesus Christ. So if he gets, you know, if there's too much made about Hitler, he can't stand it. And it has to be, you know, it has to be undone. I think that might be part of it. But also his anti-racism comes from the church, and also any kind of religion that would come up opposing the Catholic Church, he's also very, you know, will take down and tear down. So he says also, dig deeply beneath the Orthodox Judaic surface and you will excavate rabbinic admiration for Hitler as God's avenging angel against the majority of 20th century European Judaics who were in the process of liberating themselves from the prison house of Talmudism. Now, if you followed that, you know, it's like he wants to save the Jews from their Talmudism. Now, the Talmud is anti-Christian, very, very anti-Christian, anti-Jesus, all of that. And so the Talmud is the worst part of Judaism, obviously, to Michael Hoffman. And if the Jews would stop being anti-Christian, if they would drop the Talmud, and they would not be anti-Christ, they would be okay, is the way what I get from him. Because he said, in other words, you know, Hitler stopped the liberation of the Jews by what he was doing, and the continuing emancipation of the Jews with his persecution of Jews. And he made the Germans hated around the world. He made them the target of Jews. And if he hadn't have done that, everything would be better. And maybe the Jews would be freed from their belief in the Talmud and their ugly religion, as he sees it. So again, we're going to the break, but if for him, it's all about religion. And for him, religion is the Catholic Church. Well, there's just no doubt about that. And there's a few more items from Michael Hoffman, and then I'll go on to that are pretty darn good. And they're so common of the kind of things that people say about Hitler who want to want to keep him out of any kind of white movement. But at the same time, he's a little more extreme than a lot of them are. So we're going to listen to the regular break music, but I hope by next week I'm going to have a new music show. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on September 21st, the equinox, fall equinox of 2013. And we're now on Michael Hoffman and his rather virulent attacks on Adolf Hitler's and National Socialism. And I'm going to go now to another blog post of his, which is a letter to Hans Krampe. You know, I remember this. It was not all that long ago. It says 2000. He wrote this. Boy, time flies. Longer ago than I would have thought. Hans wrote a response letter to something that Michael Hoffman had written. And of course, he's a big supporter of Adolf Hitler. And it was very long. So then Michael Hoffman wrote a rather much shorter reply back to Hans. And here's some excerpts from that. He said, "There is undoubtedly a number of World War II revisionists who view the revisionist movement mainly as a means for rehabilitating the reputation of the murderous tyrant, Adolf Hitler." Well, of course, he includes Hans in that category, which would be true. Ergo, revisionists who expose Hitler as the grave digger of the German people are, as Mrs. Zundel writes, shameful. Well, Ingrid Zundel had posted Hans's letter to Hoffman on her website and spoken well of it, and that's what Hoffman is referring to here. He's a revisionist, not just a Holocaust revisionist, but he sees himself as a revisionist of that period of time, the World War II period and the Holocaust. But he's one who exposes Hitler as the grave digger of the German people. This is very common. To say that is not so extreme, but to say murderous tyrant is a bit. That's what a lot of people think. Hoffman says of himself, "My area of study is the psychology and epistemology of the last truly believed state religion of the world, Holocaustianity. One avenue of research I am pursuing," I'm getting the hiccups now, "is the claim that Adolf Hitler enjoyed the support of the majority of the German people from his rise to power until 1945. I do not believe that to be the case. It seems to me that Hitler's behavior and ideology are remarkably rabbinic in nature, particularly his race worship and emphasis on revenge and war." So you see, race worship, as he names it, is a problem in Christianity. It's a problem for Hoffman's brand of Christianity. It's a problem for Hoffman. And also, when he says that Hitler had an emphasis, put emphasis on revenge and war, I disagree with that totally. That was not Hitler who did that, but it was Churchill and Roosevelt who definitely did that. And of course, they were under the influence of the Jews, and the Jews are the ones known most for revenge and war. And yet Hoffman turns it around and says that this was Hitler's nature, and that Hitler had the nature of the Talmud, that he was actually very Judaic in his thinking. This is the way that that Hoffman puts it. Doesn't seem to be, not too many people, well, I mean, it doesn't seem to be very credible to me at all. Anyway, he wrote a little something about National Socialism in another article about Bishop Williamson, and he said, "The tragic deaths of hundreds of thousands of Judaic persons under the Nazis is given the name of Holocaust." Well, you know, he's not the only revisionist who talks about the tragic deaths, how tragic it was that these so many Jews died, he calls them Judaic persons, died during the war. He calls it under the Nazis, but okay. But what should be done with these Judaic persons? What should have been done with them? What should be done with them today? His answer seems to be to get them away from the Talmud, to change their Judaic beliefs, and then they'll fit in just fine into society. That seems to be his answer. All right, Michael Kohlhaas is somebody who I've liked for a long time, but And when I saw that Why Hitler Won't Work article he wrote, which is quite some time ago, I think I read some of it to see what he was saying, and I'm sure I didn't read all of it. If I did read all of it, there's four parts to it. It's pretty long, therefore. And it's on his website, michaelcolehaze.biz, C-O-L-H-A-Z-E. His very beautiful website, seductively beautiful. That website is seductively beautiful. You want to talk about, you know, seduction. I mean, it's sort of odd for someone who's loves the Catholic Church the way he does. But he loves a European culture, and he loves beauty, obviously. He's an artist. He's quite a talented, brainy person, too. I mean, he's I still hold him in high esteem, but I have to say that after reading this article more carefully, I don't forgive him for writing this, because I'm going to go right ahead now and read some excerpts from it. In the beginning of this, he starts out real friendly with Hitler, and he likes Hitler and talks about what a nice person he is and good ideas he has. And, you know, he's okay with him up to a certain point. And then when we get into the war years, then it's not okay anymore. So Hitler's personal credo included, as dragon's teeth that would eventually become a harvest of death and destruction, the likewise divinely approved mission to Hitler's divinely approved mission to subjugate lesser folk into near slavery after first conquering their ancestral lands. Well, he's not talking about Jews here. He's got to be talking about Russians, I'd say. But Slavs and Russians is who he's unhappy with the way they were treated under Adolf Hitler. He says Hitler's world picture consisted of two imperative components, namely the Aryan race and himself as its Messiah. Well, I don't think he saw himself as its Messiah, but he saw himself as having a work to do for the German people, which he intended to carry through to completion as if he could do so. And I think Michael Kohlhaas has to agree with the imperative of the Aryan race, but so where he doesn't agree is with the Messiah part, to think that Hitler would put himself in place of, again, God and Christ. That's his problem. Again, the problem of the Christian. He says, the question is therefore why his entire philosophy changed already early in life so radically that he tried to undo 2,000 years of Christian doctrine by bending the arms of the crucifix into the barbs of a swastika, thereby replacing Christ's message of love and compassion with the dogma of an unforgiving nature. You see, now, to me, that's propaganda. That isn't any understanding of Adolf Hitler at all. So why he writes in such an extreme way, I do not know. But at the end of his article, he quotes from a book that I think he said was written in Spanish or something, and he's going to talk about it in another. He's going to write about that book in another article. I didn't have the time to look for it, but which one he was talking about. But he quotes this section from it, and it has this line in it: "Bending the arms of the crucifix into the barbs of the swastika." So he didn't make that up himself, but he liked it from what this other person wrote, and repeated it here at an earlier part of his article. He says, the dogma of an unforgiving nature, one that favored the strong and condemned the weak, one whose iron rule permitted nothing but the survival of the fittest. Well, you know, Hitler did not promote an iron rule of the survival of the fittest. That just is not, that's a... It's just not true, you know. It wasn't like that. So then he says, one that had long since decreed that human existence could only guarantee its continuation by a drastic division into masters and serfs. Now, that's absolutely not true. National Socialism was not a division into masters and serfs, and Hitler didn't, you know, in his megalomania or whatever, wasn't preparing to turn it into that. And he hadn't turned it into that. But this is the way Cole Hayes wants to see it. And then Cole Hayes writes, Hitler gave the answer himself, life. So he's saying that the answer to the question, why he tried to undo 2,000 years of Christian doctrine, was life. I hate to take the time, but in my opinion, and I may be one of these days on a program, I'll explain all this, if anybody wants to hear it. Life is the name of God. The name of God is life. So I would agree with what he's saying here. You know, that's a good thing. It's a good thing to put in the place of Christian doctrine, perhaps. Life rather than death. All right, justified. And he justifies what he just said here with this quote from Mein Kampf, from Hitler in Mein Kampf. In the end, only the urge for self-preservation will triumph. Beneath it, the so-called compassion, put in quotes, that mixture of stupidity, cowardice, and know-it-all conceit will melt like snow in the March sun. Mankind has grown great in eternal struggle, and only in eternal peace will it perish. Those who want to live, let them fight, and those who do not want to fight in this world of eternal struggle do not deserve to live. All who are not of good race in this world are chaff. Oh, Cole Hayes doesn't like that. He writes, at a time when the white race has, at least in the Western world, lost indeed the will to fight and is in mortal danger to be vanquished by its enemies, these words have a profound allure. The problem is that they suggest, even if partly true, utterly immoral means for their implementation. So he thinks if you say that if you want to live, you have to fight, and if you're not worthy, and if you aren't willing to fight, you don't deserve to live. He considers that to be utterly immoral. Then he starts quoting David Irving, not David Irving. Sorry about that. I brought in David Irving as saying he starts quoting Albert Speer, Hitler's architect, who during the trials and after in his books during the Nuremberg trials, turned against Hitler and degraded Hitler with a lot of his comments that were just uncalled for. And you know, I've got an article to post on that, which I had forgotten all about. I'm going to get on that as soon as I can. Anyway, Albert Speer, you know, is a real friend to those who want to call Hitler some kind of a megalomaniac who wanted to, you know, rule the world and so on by the things that he said. But he didn't say those things when Hitler was alive. He didn't even act that way. He was very much in support of Hitler. Unless he's just a person who's dishonest all the way around, which you have to question that man. But I call him a David Irving type person, Albert Speer. Anyway, I don't have any quotes about that because it was too much, but they're in the article. Then Cole Hayes says, thus as early as 1933, big prisons, euphemistically called KZ, but not euphemistically, that was the word in German, and he ought to know that. I'm sure he does know that. Or concentration camps began to host dangerous dissidents and other Volksschädlinge, which is a word for people's parasites. Dangerous dissidents and parasites, which is what the National Socialist term for them, a development that increased over the years while any opposition was met with ever-increasing draconian retribution, as happened to lovely Sophie Scholl of the White Rose, who had distributed a few rebellious pamphlets in Munich's university and was beheaded for it in her 20th year. I really resent that. He is now supporting the White Rose group, calling her lovely Sophie Scholl. She had only distributed a few rebellious pamphlets. Well, we're going to get right on that. Right away about what she did. And he points, you know, the beheading was the common execution in Germany. It had been long before Hitler got in there. Some people know that, but a lot of people either don't want to know it, or don't know it, or don't want to know it. But, you know, that wasn't anything particularly gruesome that the Nazis were doing. That was the way it had been done, and they hadn't changed it. It was only some time, quite a while after the war, that they changed that and stopped that, using the guillotine. Maybe it was considered more humane than some other ways. Anyway, this is what he's coming to the defense of Sophie Scholl here. And then he said this: "We have thus the strange case of a highly intelligent and powerful man who set out with genuinely good intentions and accomplished feats of great valor for the improvement of Germany, whose basic ideas about the diversity of mankind and the perseverance and protection of a given tribe were essentially sound," the tribe being the German tribe, "but his unbending fanaticism, his messianic folly, his pathological need for self-aggrandizement, his cold and unforgiving heart with respect to lesser humans, and his subsequent desertion of the most basic morals made him lose his way so completely that he ended up as a brutal tyrant." Wow. You know, I mean, that's extreme. That's what I don't forgive. You know, if he can write something like that, and, you know, I don't see how he could be argued. It would be a long argument, but there's plenty of ways to do it. But anyway, he goes on to say, "Perhaps he didn't notice that the lights had changed and thus paved the way for the victory of the usurers that strangle us today." Now, this really gets me. Yeah, so he's blaming Hitler for the fact that we're under usury today, when it was Hitler who threw them out of Germany and was trying to continue, and they went to war on him, a world war, a whole bunch of countries all at the same time, you know, attacked him, and they fought valiantly in order for the victory of usury. It wasn't Hitler who paved the way. This is real stupid of Michael Kohlhaas. So then I have to take back everything I've said about him being such an intelligent man, and you know, such a blah blah, all this stuff because of his seductive website. Anyway, further, Michael's belief is, I guess I wrote this, he wrote this. "Our Führer," let's see, where is this from? "Our Führer has created a new religion and elevated himself to its Messiah. He has bent the arms of the cross and distorted it into a swastika. In doing so, he replaced Christ's icon of..." Well, I already read this to you. "Christ's icon of love and compassion with the symbol of brute power." Well, I'm just saying that this is what he, what Michael, how Michael sees it. So I'm going to now see how much I can get done in this book. And I'm going to start with, now this is the book, The White Rose, supposedly by Ng Scholl. Now, I didn't think all the way through. Did I already say this, that I thought this, she didn't write this book because it was written as such propaganda, but also that it was written like fiction. That if you a fiction writer knows the thoughts and feelings and words and so on of every every character in his book, because he or she invented them. And so, you know, they speak, you know, the characters are speaking away and telling how they feel, their attitudes are described and so on. And you don't question why it's known, because it's fiction and the author is inventing it. But in this book, it's nonfiction, but this Ng Scholl supposedly knows every thought, feeling, and whatever of her brother Hans and her sister Sophie while they are not with her, you know, and she wasn't even involved in what they were doing and didn't want to hear about it. But somehow she knows all this because she writes it it's written in that manner, you know, like a fiction book would be written. So I was very suspicious, but the fact is that it also, and then I got to page 94 after her story is over, and it's called Concluding Remarks, and supposedly written in 1969, and it says this book was, get my, so I can see this. This book was written in 1947 for use in the schools for adolescents from the age of 13 to 18. I was shocked. I was shocked that they said that, that they put that in here. Written in 1947, at the height of the denazification period, where they, you know, had everything, their new, all their new educational materials being put out and so on. For use in the schools, for adolescents between the ages of 13 and 18, it was addressed to the young people who had grown up in the Hitler Youth and had experienced the great disappointment of their lives as a result of the Second World War. Children who at that time were asking their parents, how was it possible for you to be taken in by the Nazis? It was written also for the, this is what they were telling the kids in school, because the parents were probably telling them the truth at home. It was written also for those of their elders who were ready to face up to their past. Because of the circumstances of its publication, this book may have occasioned some misunderstanding. It requires a word in conclusion. So they write a bunch of stuff which would be probably good to say, but I think it's all fairly well known. So I'm going to move on after that, telling you, you know, what this book is really all about. But they have the documents at the back. And the first document is the indictment of Hans and Sophie Scholl and Christoph Probst. And the indictment gives their names and personal information. It says they are accused that in 1942 and 1943 in Munich, Augsburg, Salzburg, Vienna, Stuttgart, and Linz, committing together the same acts, one with attempted high treason, namely by force, to change the constitution of the Reich, and acting with intent, one to organize a conspiracy for the preparation of high treason, two, to render the armed forces unfit for the performance of their duty of protecting the German Reich against internal and external attack. Three, to influence the masses through the preparation and distribution of writings. And now, so far, I just want to point out, can you disagree with any of that? You know, I can't disagree. They're not exaggerating anything. What they're saying is actually what they were doing, what they wanted to do. And if you look at it from the point of view of the government, it is certainly, treasonable. So then going on in the indictment two with having a number two with having attempted in the internal area of the Reich during time of war to give aid to the enemy against the Reich, injuring the war potential of the Reich. That's also true. And number three, with having attempted to cripple and weaken the will of the German people to take measures toward their defense and self-determination. That's also true. They wanted to cause the people to believe that there was a lot of dissent out there, a lot of disagreement, and a lot of resistance when there really wasn't, and to cause them to then lose faith and so on. Now, I'm going to read the summary of results. Do I want to read that? The summary of results of investigations. Well, they talk about their father. You know, I could read all this. I could always come back to it maybe if I feel like I need to. It tells, you know, what they did. In the summer of 1942, the so-called leaflets of the White Rose were distributed through the mails. These seditious pamphlets contain attacks on National Socialism and on its cultural political policies in particular. Further, they contain statements concerning the alleged atrocities of National Socialism, namely the alleged murder of the Jews and the alleged forced deportation of the Poles. In addition, the leaflets contain the demand to, quote, to obstruct the continued functioning of the atheistic war machine, unquote, by passive resistance before it is too late and before the last of the German cities, like Cologne, become heaps of ruins and German youth has bled to death for, quote, the hubris of the subhuman, unquote, meaning Adolf Hitler being the subhuman. According to leaflet number two, a wave of unrest must go through the land. If, quote, it is in the air, unquote, if many participate, Then in the great final effort, this system can be shaken off. An end with terror, the leaflet stated, is preferable to terror without end. In leaflet 3, the idea is developed that it is in the intent and goal of passive resistance to bring down National Socialism. In this struggle, one should not hesitate to take any course, to do any deed, as all participate, no, to do any deed. At all points, National Socialism must be attacked wherever it may be vulnerable. Not military victory should be the first concern of every German, but rather the defeat of National Socialism. That is, you know, don't, instead of working for military victory, work for the defeat of National Socialism. Every committed opponent of National Socialism must therefore ask himself how he can most effectively struggle against the present state and deal it the most telling blows. To this end, the sabotage in the armament plants and war industry, the obstruction of the smooth functioning of the war machine, and sabotage of all National Socialist functions, as well as in all areas of scientific and intellectual life, is demanded. A total of 4 separate leaflets of this sort were distributed in Munich at that time. In January, February of 1943, 2 separate seditious leaflets were distributed by means of random scattering and through the mails, and they go on about details about all that. And they say about number 3, the accused Hans Scholl occupied his thoughts for a long time with the political situation. He arrived at the conclusion that just as in 1918, so also after the seizure of power by the National Socialists in 1933, it was not the majority of the German masses, but the intellectuals in particular who had failed politically. This is the only explanation, in his opinion, why mass movements with simplistic slogans had succeeded in drowning out all thought that was more profound. Accordingly, he felt it his duty to remind the middle-class intellectuals of their political obligations, one of which was to take up the struggle against National Socialism. And they say how he got together with his friend Alexander Schmorell. They acquired a typewriter. They started drafting the leaflets. They did that together single-handedly, and then they mailed them out using names from the Munich telephone directory. They only had about 100 to start with. And then they had to go to active service on the front. I think I went through the story quite a bit. Now I'm going to move to Sophie Scholl. They say, we're still in the indictment here. The accused Sophie Scholl, as early as the summer of 1942, took part in political discussions in which she and her brother Hans Scholl came to the conclusion that Germany had lost the war. Thus, she shared with her brother the view that agitation against the war should be carried out through leaflets. She claims to be unable to remember whether the idea of the preparation of leaflets had its inception with her or with her brother. Well, see, she's trying to take, you know why she did that? They know, they see through that. She's trying to take the blame. She doesn't remember. Of course, it wasn't her. She was not even involved when they started the thing out. So, so that's the way that goes. She claims that she had no part in the preparation and distribution of the leaflets with the title The White Rose, and that she did not become aware of them until a friend showed her a copy. On the other hand, she admits to having taken part in preparing and distributing the leaflets in 1943. Together with her brother, she drafted the text of the seditious leaflets of the resistance in Germany. She had a part in purchasing the paper, envelopes, and stencils, and together with her brother, she actually prepared the duplicated copies of this leaflet. She helped her brother dress the envelopes for mailing. At the request of her brother, she traveled by express trains to Augsburg and Stuttgart and put the prepared letters into various mailboxes. And she took part in the distribution of the leaflets in Munich by depositing them in telephone booths and parked automobiles. she didn't have anything to do with the defacement of the buildings. Now, they say for about the accused Probst, only one paragraph, who was often in the company of brother and sister Scholl, and who shared their ideas, wrote at the request of the accused Hans Scholl the draft mentioned above, of the one that he had in his pocket when he was arrested, of his estimate of the current political scene. He claims, to be sure, that he did not know that Scholl intended to use the draft for a leaflet, but he did admit that he was aware that it might be used for illegal propaganda. Then they have part four here is their testimony and the exhibits. And then they have in the name of the German people that they find that these three should be punished by death. And they give their reasons why. And it's kind of long. That, you know, they were given help in their university studies to go to university and so on by the Führer. They give credit in this National Socialist system. The Führer is the head of all. And so it's through his benevolence, in a sense, that these programs are made, possible for the people. And, they had these programs available to them, both to Hans, they're saying that he, I really like to read it in their own words, but it said that he, was allowed to continue his university medical studies, even though he was drafted. You know, at a certain age in Germany at that time, we're talking about 1942, everybody was drafted. All the young males were drafted. And so if you were given permission to do other things, so he was a soldier and had to spend a certain amount of time on the front, but as a medical aide, and he was also allowed to then be on leave for long periods of time to attend the university. And this was considered a benefit and a good thing for him that was done by the National Socialist State, which he showed no gratitude for and so on. And she also, well, I don't know about that. So let me go on to something else here. The next page. It's on. All right. The light's not real great because of the way I've got this book held. I want to say that they talked about how they traveled around all that time that they spent doing all these things. And Probst likewise began his medical studies. Sorry about this. This is about as far as I really got here. So then they say, all of the accused have admitted the facts stated above. And that's true. I mean, these are not anything out of the ordinary. These are just what they've said in court are just the things that they actually did admit. And it does say, it said somewhere I read that both Hans and Sophie were denying that they were involved in any of that in their first interrogations. But there was so much evidence against them that the police had gathered, including the letter in his pocket, but all kinds of things, you know, that they finally realized. And I don't know if they were together when they were, I can't imagine that they were together, but they seemed to know the same thing at the same time, the two of them. But they finally admitted, or maybe, you know, that yes, because there's no point in denying it. So then they signed all this, and there was nothing that was not true about it. You know, there's nothing. The police did not try to create, or the prosecutors bring out things that weren't absolutely the facts. Oh, here's the good part I like. They said Probst was a non-political man, hence no man at all, they say. In the court papers, in the court, the reading of the, what this is called, the grounds for their for why they were given the death penalty. Probst claims he's a non-political man, hence no man at all, they say. Neither the solicitude of the National Socialist Reich for his professional training, he was also a doctor in training, nor the fact that it was only the National Socialist demographic policy, which made it possible for him to have a family. He's the one who had married and had three children. It prevented him from writing at the behest of Scholl in Cowardly Defeatism, a manuscript which takes the heroic struggle in Stalingrad as the occasion for defaming the Führer as a military swindler, and which then, progressing to a hortatory tone, calls for opposition to National Socialism and for actions which would lead, as he pretends, to an honorable capitulation. To think that there could have been an honorable capitulation with Roosevelt and Churchill at this date is really... This is what was wrong with all of that treason and all of that resistance, that they thought they would, you know, get a good deal with the Allies, which, you know, absolutely no way, and Hitler knew that. And even some National Socialists might not have known that, but the inner circle knew that. It was impossible. They had tried and tried to do something like that. They wouldn't, you know, they couldn't do it. They wanted a total defeat of Germany so they could do what they've done since. So anyway, they're again saying that this Christoph Probst was being treated well by the National Socialist State. But, you know, they were all expected to serve the state, and this is what they didn't like. And this is an issue at bottom differences of opinion here. People who hate the whole idea of serving the state and thinking that it's communist, and the people who see that a National Socialist state is your own people, and so you're there to serve you're serving your own people, but even in that, some of them didn't want to. They wanted to do what they wanted to do. They didn't want their lives so prescribed, and your life would not have been so prescribed if it wasn't, the country wasn't in such a serious war. You know, it wasn't going on like that before the war. So by bringing that war onto Germany, they were able to cause all this difficulties with the amongst the German people and so on. Would otherwise have been okay with National Socialism. So it goes on to say that about Christoph Probst, on the grounds why he should have the death penalty. He supports the promises. He supports the promises in this leaflet by citing Roosevelt, the judge says with the exclamation point, and his knowledge about these matters he derived from listening to British broadcasts. So British broadcasts, you know, are again brought up, that it came out in the interrogations that they were listening to this, and it says Probst tried to excuse himself by his psychotic depression brought on by the defeat at Stalingrad and the childbed illness of his wife. His wife was having their third child, and she was having some, you know, hard time with it and had to stay in bed. So, but this doesn't fly. Now, You're going to have to bear with me while I look back further here, because I didn't mark anything more than this. Because I think there's something I want to read. Then, they give all the things from the Schorell and Graf trial, too. And then, what's all this? Boy, sorry I didn't get this taken care of, but I know there was a lot that I thought was good in here. Elsie Gibble. These are some letters from some people who were friends of theirs in support. They all came later. But here you have the basic accusations that I did read, although they go on with more of them. They go on with more of them, but the fact that they considered this to be very serious treason, and they spelled out why and what it was, and that these I read that. All right. Whoever has, like the three accused, committed the acts of high treason, weakening the home front, and thereby, in time of war, the security of the nation, and by the same token has aided the enemy, which is what they did do, raises the dagger for a stab in the back of the front. This is in the court. This was the findings of the court in the section about grounds. I'm going to read that again. Whoever has committed acts of high treason, weakening the home front, that's serious, and thereby in time of war, the security of the nation, and by the same token has aided the enemy, which what they did was aiding the enemy, raises the dagger for a stab in the back of the front. Stab in the back comes from World War One. What the Jews were doing on the home front. That applies also to Probst, though he claims that his manuscript was not intended for use as a leaflet, since the tone and style of the manuscript proves the opposite. Whoever acts in this way, and particularly at this time, they keep mentioning that it's wartime, when we must close our ranks, is attempting to cause the first rift in the unity of the battlefront. And German students, whose traditional honor has always called for self-sacrifice for Volk and Fatherland, were the ones who acted thus. If a deed of this sort were to be punished otherwise than by death, we would be forging the first links of a chain whose end in an earlier time was 1918. Therefore, for the protection of the Volk and the Reich at war, the People's Court has found that one just punishment death. The People's Court knows that it is at one with our soldiers in this decision. Through this treason to our Volk, the accused have forever forfeited their citizenship. Well, of course, it was all undone after 1945. And everything that the National Socialists did was undone. And these people are now, you know, heroes and martyrs to the cause of a free Germany. Now, I want to ask if anybody has, somebody had called, but I couldn't answer at that time. If anybody has an opinion that's intelligent on this about, doesn't it seem as though, who was immoral here? Who was being immoral? This is the question I've asked at the start, and I think I've got my head together here. Who was being immoral? Was it Adolf Hitler and his government and his courts that found what the White Rose was doing at a time of war, wanting to bring down the government? During wartime, wanting to stop the war, wanting to cause the defeat of the Wehrmacht and all its in the Luftwaffe and everything. Well, that's the Wehrmacht. Wanting to cause the defeat of our forces, wanting to force a surrender, wanting to save the Jews, wanting to do this in the name of this. The worst thing that the government was doing in their eyes was how they were treating the Jews, that somewhere it was that 300,000 Jews had died in the war. Where is that? Now, that might be somewhere else I haven't gotten to yet. But worried about how the Poles and the Russians were being treated when the government and the military knew what needed to be done with the enemy who they were fighting, and we know all the atrocities that were being committed on German soldiers. I don't know if the people were given that information at that time because they didn't want to say things that were so discouraging and ugly, and they didn't want also the families to be not wanting their males to go into the, or to be worrying about them in the fighting on the Eastern Front that they were being ambushed and tortured and killed in this way, these horrible ways. They didn't want to tell that to the families or to the people. So all the people heard, if they were listening to foreign broadcasts, was all this atrocity propaganda against the Germans. And they weren't getting the other story from the Germans because they, you know, various reasons. They didn't want to talk about things like that, what the soldiers were facing. But they were doing what they needed to do. And in 1942, we know that the stories about gassing the Jews or killing the Jews in some strange ways and all kinds of strange chambers and so on were being sent out by Poles, communists, and Jews to the West and to London. And even though they didn't believe it, they allowed it to go out as as propaganda. But actually, the intelligence of U.S. military intelligence and British military intelligence, they knew better. They knew what was going on. But, you know, naturally, the propaganda is terrible during the war, and it's been terrible ever since. So, and this little book is just a part of it. That's what's so interesting about it. But they do have this all this good information in the back. And as I read, I wish I could... You know, there's so much of it, and it's hard to just pick out one little spot and read that. But as I read this about the how the court operated and what was said and what they found, and all of these, all six of these who were executed admitted to what they had done, you know, because they couldn't deny it. They say here in talking about the Schmorell, the second trial with Schmorell in it, that the findings are based on their own statements of the accused. And the number one, the leaflet Students was written by Huber, Professor Huber. And in number two, in Stuttgart, it was not Sophie Scholl, but Hans Herzl who put the leaflets in the mails. Sophie Scholl had brought them to him in Ulm. So Sophie told them that she had put the envelopes in the mail, and they believed her, and they had that in the first trial, in her trial. But later they did correct that, because they said later they found from Hans Herzl, who was, see, that Gazella named all these people. So they're all on trial, not just the three, not just Schmorell, Huber, and Willie Graf in the second trial, but all these others too, who got different kinds of, I should probably read some of that if I can find it now, in the time that I have left, got different lengths of prison terms. And they explained, the judges explained why. I didn't find any problem with any of it. Of course, if I was sympathetic to their cause, I could easily, you know, see it as a problem and think that's so unfair and, you know, excessive. But they took these as very serious. They took this, what the White Rose was doing, as very, very serious. And so the sentences seemed to be just and fair according to that point of view. And and this Grimminger, who was an adult who contributed 500 marks towards their expenses. Let's see now if I can find these. I know I can find them, just how long it's going to take me. Dr. Freezer. Nope, that's not it. Too far. Okay. The next group of accused, okay, wait a minute. The identical case can be laid against Graf, Huber. Okay, Huber was interesting because, you know, he could have gotten away with it all, as I had said, but he got caught. He knew of the work of Scholl, who had told him of his ideas, plans, and acts, and he took part in the meetings, edited the leaflet to all Germans, furnish the draft of the leaflet students. They've got all this down here. Everything that they did. All right, here's this call. At the last minute, since I'm only kind of bumbling around here, I'm going to take this call. If he'll hold on and see what this person has to say. Let's see if I remember to answer a call. It's been so long. Okay. Hello there. Are you there? There's someone. This is area code 718. Hi, can you hear me? Oh, they hung up. Or it didn't take. I think this is Don again. Every time he calls in, his call doesn't go through. I don't know what's wrong with his number. So we're going to have to let that go. It doesn't work. So I was saying that some of these people he did get the death sentence, but for the sake of the... All right. These two men toward the Fuhrer deserve punishment, since though they knew it to be forbidden by the Fuhrer, they listened to discussion of military and internal political affairs on the foreign radio. This they did repeatedly on weekends together in a ski hut. They're talking about, who are they talking about here? Two of the Bollinger and, let me see if I can find that list of, what they, there's the action of their names, but it doesn't say what they were, what their sentence was. Somehow, sorry about this, folks. I'm really screwing up the ending here. The next group of the accused, okay, Bollinger and Bauer, despite their knowledge of the treasonous anti-German activities, failed to report their information and in addition listened to the enemy. So they were mostly that they knew about it and they didn't report it. So that was another aspect of criminal behavior, that if you're aware of it and you didn't report it to the authorities, which a lot of people wouldn't do, but anyway, since they get caught knowing about it and don't do it, and since this was something that they had considered such a big deal. Again, these people were involved in the Catholic Youth and so on, some of them. After Hoover, as regards the significance, I just can't find the sentences that they got. But the largest sentences were like 18 years. And then went down to 5 years, you know, several years. And then they had some at the very bottom that were half a year. And these girls, all these girls got sentenced. Even the girl Gisela, who was the good National Socialist, who turned in all this evidence to them once she was, you know, being interrogated. And then later, though, she denied some of it, but she was helpful, but she knew, she's another one, because she knew about it, and she did not, report it. They gave her 6 months in prison. That was the smallest one, was 6 months. I think, because I don't know why I don't have any of that marked. So that was the story, ladies and gentlemen. And I guess if I can try to sum up a little bit. I messed up this last time. I worked so hard to get enough time, and then I screwed up the end of it. But let's see. I've got some notes that I wasn't having. So you might say... you know, I've talked about my feelings about Christianity, and of course, Christian Identity is the only Christian sect I know, if I can call it that, that has figured out and has an answer to the racial problem. to the fact that God only cares about the white race. And that's part of why it's so attacked, because people, even other Christian identists like that, Eli James, will say that that's too cruel and that can't be true. And so, you know, God loves, the same God loves, cares about all these people, and he has a plan for them of some sort. So, you know, nobody can deal with this. When they get involved with the Bible and Christian churches or Christian teachings, Christian writers, whatever, and except for hardcore, I guess, Christian identity people like Bill Fink. But I would say that spirituality is very important to the white race. Spirituality is necessary to... got 60 seconds. I'm not hearing it, so I don't know why. I guess somebody called and hung up. I don't know. Anyway, I think the best way to exercise your spirituality to make sure that you don't go spiritually dead is to meditate. Because, you know, we need to exercise our bodies, we need to exercise our minds, and we also need to exercise our spirit. But, you know, the churches, in my experience, don't trust people who meditate and don't encourage people to meditate because you're unsupervised. They're not supervising you in what you're getting, and they often believe that you're going to be led astray by the devil if you do your own work in that regard. So anyway, 10 minutes and the show. I want to thank you all for listening today. Hope you got something out of it, and come back the next time. Good afternoon.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.